University, who will talk about detection of magnetic fields in cool supergiants. I'll give you
I'm actually not from Brock University. I think that's a typo on the schedule. That's okay. I'm from Queens. So I'm Nixa, and I'm actually working currently at the Royal Military College of Canada in Kingston with a group of researchers, including Dr. Greg Waite, who is my supervisor, and Jason Grunhut. And we are interested in the detection of magnetic fields in stars, specifically cool supergiants. So why should anybody care about the magnetic fields of stars? Well, for one thing, it could really provide a lot of insight as to the structure and evolution of different types of stars. Magnetic fields play in that process. There's also a lot of really complex physics that takes place within a star. So there's radiation, there's convection, and we want to know, again, how magnetic fields influence these things and how, in turn, they are influenced by them. And finally, we want to know if there are any relationships between some fundamental stellar parameters and magnetic fields. So what I mean by fundamental stellar parameters are things like temperature or surface gravity or the age or size of the star, these kinds of things. Do we find that there are any trends between any of these things and whether or not the star has a magnetic field? So we've had evidence that magnetic fields exist for quite a long time now, thanks to observations of our sun. So phenomena such as sunspots and solar flares arise due to these localized effects of magnetic fields. So you can see there on the image on the left, the sunspots are forming near the equator of the star, and they move out from there. And on the image on the right, we have these solar flares, and they're essentially jets of plasma that are ejected from the surface of the sun. And in that picture, you can see kind of two time steps, so you really see the plasma kind of billowing out from the surface. So although we have some sort of understanding of the theory behind the sun's magnetic field, we're still unable to really model how it's generated, and we're unable to really predict how it's going to evolve. So the great thing about this survey is that we look at a variety of other stars. We look at a whole bunch of other stars. And so we can really take what we learn from these other stars and bring it back home to our sun. Now, we can also use what we know about the sun, of course, and apply that to all these new stars that we're observing. So before I actually dive into what my research is, I want to give you some background on a couple of things that we're going to try to bring together. So what are supergiants anyways? Well, they are among the more massive stars. So we're talking about stars with 10 to about 25 times the mass of our sun. They are also larger stars. So again, we're talking about stars with radii ranging between 30 to 500 times that of our sun. And therefore, they are amongst the brightest objects in our sky. And this is great because it means that we can achieve a high precision in our measurements. And as astronomers, we're thrilled that, you know, we're looking at bright objects because it means that we can collect data on them even when the nights aren't perfectly clear. And finally, supergiants are descendants of main sequence OB-type stars, and I'll explain exactly what that means. Now, I'm not sure how many people are familiar with a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram or an HR diagram, but this is one right here. So you can see along the x-axis, we have temperature from hot to cool. And you can see that there's a letter that's attributed to different temperature ranges. And that's what we call the spectral type. So if someone says, you know, I'm studying stars with of spectral type A, what they mean is that they're studying stars with temperatures ranging between something like 8 to 10,000 Kelvin. Now, along the y-axis, we have luminosity. And you can see this distinctive band going diagonally across the diagram. That's what we call main sequence. So those are main sequence stars, and most stars fall along or just off of the main sequence. So if we go along the main sequence over to the OB stars up in the left-hand corner, those are the stars that are going to grow into supergiants at one stage in their life. So as they age, they become cooler and they become larger. And I'm looking at 69 supergiants with spectral types between A to M, so kind of right that center section of supergiants right there. Now, another thing I want to talk about is stellar spectrum. You've seen a few examples of that in previous presentations, but a spectrum is essentially a measurement of the flux coming in as a function of wavelength. And you can kind of see in this crude diagram there that there are these dips. And those dips are absorption lines. And anything in between the absorption lines is what we call the continuum. So the best way to think about this is to consider the core of the star as being this hot continuum source. And surrounding this hot continuum source is this relatively cool stellar atmosphere, and it's composed of a variety of different elements, such as magnesium or calcium or iron and hydrogen. And so certain wavelengths are, of course, absorbed by the radiation that's emitted from the core. So at this point, we can actually start kind of building the theory of how we're going to detect magnetic fields in stars. Now, I'm not sure how many people are familiar with the Zeeman effect. Anyone? Okay, great. So I only just saw it in my quantum course last semester. But the Zeeman effect is exactly what we're going to exploit to determine whether or not a star has a magnetic field or not. So for those of you who don't know, atoms have different energy levels, and sometimes more than one quantum state occupies a certain energy level, and that's what we call degeneracy. So the Zeeman effect is the splitting of degenerate energy levels on the application of a weak magnetic field. So you can see in the diagram on the left-hand side, I have the first three levels of hydrogen, and that's when the magnetic field is off. And then when I turn the magnetic field on, you see that the splitting has occurred from the degenerate energy level. So for example, the N equals 2 state has now split into two different energy levels, each with a distinct energy. So as you may have guessed by now, we're going to see the exact same splitting taking place in our spectral lines, in those absorption lines. And that's exactly how we're going to detect magnetic fields in stars. And the splitting is actually proportional to the strength of the magnetic field. Now, one thing to bear in mind is that these newly split levels actually absorb polarized light. And this will be of some importance later on in our analysis. But again, if we look at the N equals 2 level, it's now split into these two levels. And one of them is going to absorb left circular polarized light, and the other one will absorb right circular polarized light. So the team that I'm working on, we use the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope as well as the Bernard Lloyd telescope, which is in France. And the instruments that we use are called Espedons and Narval. And like I mentioned, I'm looking at 69 different stars, and the spectra that I receive cover the optical spectrum between 100 nanometers to about, or 300 nanometers, I should say, to about 1,000 nanometers. We're really lucky because we have very high resolution data, which is great because it means we can resolve some of those sharper absorption lines. So I'd like to remind you now about what I just mentioned about how the split energy levels are polarized, and how in our spectral line, whereas before we just had one absorption line, now we're going to have kind of these two split absorption lines. Now, the problem with that is that very often you lose the splitting in the intrinsic width of your original absorption line. So, what we want is kind of a method to increase our signal-to-noise ratio so that we really detect this as being a signal and not just noise. So the way that we do that is by using a fancy method called least squares deconvolution, or LSD. And I'm not going to get into the details of LSD too much because we'd get bogged down in a ton of math. But basically, what we do is we create a theoretical mask based on temperature and surface gravity and chemical abundance data that we can look up for the star. And this theoretical mask is essentially what we expect the spectrum of that star to look like. And at this point, we start making some assumptions. So we say, okay, let's say that all of these absorption lines have a very similar shape, and that the only thing that changes between one absorption line and the next is how much it's been stretched or compressed. And so what the LSD program does is it runs through all of these absorption lines, and it picks out a mean profile. And using this mean profile, we actually calculate a signature. And then by performing some chi-squared statistics on that signature, we're able to decide whether or not it's statistically significant enough to be considered a detection. So if none of that made any sense, that's okay, because it's really best understood using some pictures. So I have here six different graphs, and they're each of a different star. And each of these stars was determined to have a magnetic field. So the bottommost line that you see in the black, that is the mean profile that I mentioned that the LSD comes up with, and that represents the unpolarized light. And then the topmost line in the red, that's the actual signature. And you can see that there's, you know, a variety of different signatures, and some are more complex than others. And that indicates the complexity of the magnetic field itself. And then finally, we have a null profile, and that's the center line. And all that is you know, if we see a significant squiggle right underneath the signature on the blue line, that should make us a little bit suspicious because maybe, you know, it's just an artifact of the instrument and the signature is not really there. It's just, you know, some instrumental error. So actually, you can see in that bottom left example, there's kind of a bit of a dip in the null profile. So that's, you know, that's something that I would be more suspicious about, and I would go back and look to make sure that that signal is real. So just to contrast that, now I have examples of four stars. These were all non-detections. And you can see now that in the top line, there's really nothing really happening. And the way you can think about that is that since the top line, that one represents the polarized light, or really it represents the difference between the left and the right polarized light. So if there was any splitting taking place, we would expect that if you subtracted the right polarized light from the left polarized light, that you would get, you know, something not zero. So when we do get something that's, you know, pretty much zero, it's just kind of noise there, that suggests that no splitting took place, and therefore there's no magnetic field. So just to give you an idea of some of the numbers that we're looking at, out of 69 stars, 26 of them were successful detections, and the remaining 43 were not. And this, you know, it brings up some questions as to the nature of our results, because, for example, out of 14 K-type stars, 10 of them had detections. So does that mean that, you know, all K-stars have detections and we weren't really able to just see them in those four stars? Or does it mean, you know, that magnetic fields have nothing to do with spectral type at all, and that there's really more to it than that, and it's kind of a coincidence that all of these K-stars were detections? So we have a ton of work cut out for us. For one thing, one of the first things that we'd be interested in doing is taking all of the detections that we've now found and plotting those stars back onto the HR diagram, because this way we'd be able to see very clearly if there are any sort of trends or clumps. And it would be very illuminating to see, you know, what the HR diagram can tell us about where the detections lie. Alternatively, the detections might be scattered all over the place, and we might not see anything that's obvious to us. There might be some other relationships as well that are not on the HR diagram, so maybe having to do with surface gravity, and whether or not that has anything to do with whether or not we've found a magnetic field. So I mentioned that at the beginning. We'd like to know if there are any sort of relationships between any of those parameters and magnetic fields. And at one point, we'd really love to collaborate with some theorists because they could probably provide so much insight as to how these magnetic fields are generated in the first place and the mechanism behind them, because we don't really have any understanding of that at this point. And as always, we'd love to collect more data. So, I mean, this hasn't been done for a very long time, so the more data that we get, the more we can start piecing these puzzles together, and over time, of course, by observing a single star, we can learn a ton more about its magnetic field. So, you know, astronomers are always trying to get more telescope time. That's always the case. So we clearly have a lot of work cut out for us, and I actually find that really exciting. I remember that on one of my first days on the job, I was told that the group of people that I'm working with were actually one of the first people who have detected magnetic fields in these types of stars. And I found that just really cool because it means that, I mean, it's totally uncharted territory and we have a ton of questions, but we're actually succeeding in, you know, piece by piece putting a model together to explain these things, and I find that very gratifying. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions at this point.
Any questions? Marjorie.
I was wondering, have any
preliminary values for what the magnetic fields are for the stars? That's actually what I'm currently working on. So I wish I could give you numbers, but I can't yet. I'm trying to get the program that does that to actually work. But maybe I could tell you in like a week when I figure that out. Yeah.
But maybe I missed it. Did you mention O and B stars? Are some of your targets O and B stars?
No, I just mean that the supergiants kind of evolved from those stars.
Uh-huh.
So at one point they were, but now they're between A.
But you mentioned K stars also, so I'm wondering.
So the supergiants that I'm working with, the spectral types are between like A and M. Okay. So we have some K stars in there.
The reason that, so Marjorie is my former student, and I know exactly why she's asking that question, because O and B stars are progenitors of neutron stars,
yeah.
And people wonder where the magnetic fields in neutron stars come from.
Right.
And so O and B star magnetic fields are very, very interesting, but I'm sure A to K are also very interesting. Yeah. Just not some good questions. Any other questions? Yep.
Right. That was actually a question that I was curious about as well. My understanding is that a lot of it has to do, obviously, with telescope time and what's available to be observed and at what time of the year any of these stars might be observed. Also, we have constraints in terms of the spectral types or the fact that we're looking at supergiants, so that automatically makes the group smaller as well. I think that also there's something to do with, you know, how interesting we think a star might be. So a famous star like Betelgeuse, for example. Everyone wants to know more about Betelgeuse for some reason. So that would be something that, you know, if you want to get papers published and stuff, you better observe Betelgeuse because people want to know more about it. So I think there's that sort of element in it as well.
Betelgeuse, some people think it's going to be the next star to go supernova in the sky. That's one of the reasons people are
right.
excited.
Right.
Any time in the next 1,000 years.
All right.
Any other questions? No, okay, well, let's thank all the speakers.